worries for this to go wrong. Finally, she asks, "May I make a request?" Xenia has not moved from her position at the bottom step. Her hands, now freed of the newspaper, are folded primly before her again. "Of course." "Can you promise me that no member of the Romanov family will be brought to see me without my permission? Can you assure me that I will not be ambushed in your home?" A pause as Xenia tries to divine what is behind the request. And then she says, "Yes, of course. I promise." "Then I am delighted to stay." From the corner of her eye, she sees Gleb relax. William Leeds seems content to watch the exchange without contributing, but Anna does not, for a moment, believe that he is disinterested. He has an expression, something around his eyes and the laziness of his smile, that gives him the look of a speculator, the sort of man who would gamble on a horse race or a cockfight. Anna is certain that he is taking notes, trying to ascertain who in this group has the most to lose. William Leeds seems like the sort of man who is accustomed to being on the winning side. Gleb does not prolong his goodbye. He gives Anna a quick hug, a kiss on the cheek, and one final assurance that she will be safe and well cared for at Kenwood. Once her trunk has been removed from the car, he gives her a nod and then slips into the back seat. "You must forgive me," Xenia says a few moments later when he is gone. "Every word I say in your defense puts me at odds with my family. I'm simply trying to do the right thing for everyone involved. Please do not think me cruel for sending him away." Anna smiles kindly, but does not answer, because the truth is that she does not know Xenia Leeds well enough to think anything of her at all. Kenwood is a sprawling three-story house on a 56-acre estate set into a cove in Cold Spring Harbor. Every window offers panoramic views that could inspire even the most cold-hearted landscape artist. It is painted white brick with green shutters and leaded glass windows. The house has a swimming pool, six-car garage, a dock, horse stables, and its own private beach. They put Anna on the top floor in a suite of private rooms overlooking the tennis courts at the back of the property. By the time Xenia is done giving her a tour of the house, the staff has already unpacked her belongings and hung them in a cedar closet. There are fires burning merrily in all three fireplaces in the suite, one each in her bedroom, bathroom, and parlor, and lunch is set out in the small dining area. "I thought you might want to eat in your rooms today. I imagine you're still exhausted from your trip." Normally the smell of roast beef, baked potatoes, fresh bread and strong coffee would be impossible for Anna to ignore. But her attention has been arrested by something in the middle of the room. "Oh, those are for you. A gift. Something I bought for you on our trip to the West Indies last month. You're welcome to name them. I haven't gotten around to that yet. They're both female." In a cage on a round table in the middle of the room sit two gorgeous green parrots. Xenia laughs at the look of stunned delight on Anna's face. "Neither one of them can talk, I'm afraid, but I remember how much you love animals, and I thought you might like to have some company in this corner of the house." "Thank you," Anna says, a bit overwhelmed. "I love them." She gently lifts the bar that secures the door and slides her hand into the cage. Anna pets the soft, feathered head of one bird, and then the other. They are identical in size and color. Twins, perhaps. Or at least sisters. Finally, Anna looks at her host, inspiration written on her face. "They will share a name. I will call them both Janus."
Chapter 20. Anastasia. Together No More. 1918. Tobolsk, Russia. April 23rd. I'm the last one to enter Father's study. There's static in the air, an almost palpable electric charge as my parents sit tense and furious before Yakov. He paces the room, fingers laced behind his back, looking at each of us in turn. My sisters are on the verge of tears, Leshy is in attendance as well. Those odd feral eyes of his are slightly pinched. Anger, perhaps, or alarm. I can't decide what exactly he's feeling. So I take a seat in the corner of the room on a hard wooden bench beneath the window and wait for Yakov to deliver whatever bad news awaits us. I wonder how thin he really is beneath that baggy uniform. The way his jacket hangs from his shoulders and flaps at his thighs makes me think that his arms are rails and his legs spindles. I wonder whether I'm strong enough to smother him in his sleep. Probably not, I decide. Little men are quick and ruthless, and they often fight dirty. That's what Father says. They fight like mercenaries. Yakov would likely stab me in the eye before I could get the pillow over his face. Such thoughts. Only a year ago I was planting cabbages, and now I'm plotting murder. Yakov finally comes to a stop before Father. His smile is eager, his eyes shadowed by that pronounced heavy brow.
"Citizen Romanov," he says, "I have been assigned to remove you from Tobolsk."
Father blinks at him as though trying to make sense of what he has just heard. "What do you mean?"
"I mean that you are to be put on trial, and I am to take you to another location so preparations can be made."
Father grinds out his next question between clenched teeth. "What location?"
"I am afraid I cannot reveal that."
"No," he says, "I will not leave my family."
"I never said you had to leave your family. They will accompany you."
It is here that Leshy steps forward, dwarfing Yakov with every inch of his impressive height, and his impassive face finally turns to granite.
"Alexei is too sick. He won't be well enough to travel for many weeks yet."
My brother's tumble down the stairs nearly killed him. There was nothing Botkin could do to stop the bleeding. We have taken turns sitting by his bedside, terrified he would die at any moment. Though the worst has passed, Alexei is still bedridden, bruised, and unable to eat or even roll over without assistance. While Yakov considers the situation, his eyes tighten and release several times as he weighs the benefits and disadvantages of a dead 13-year-old heir.
"We do not have weeks," he says finally. "Nicholas and Alexandra will leave first thing in the morning. They will bring one daughter and half the servants. The others can stay to care for the boy until he is recovered."
My parents spend the rest of the day with Alexei, hugging him, kissing him, and saying goodbye. My brother sleeps through most of it, still too weak to raise his head or speak. Meanwhile, they leave the decision of who will go with them up to us. While they weep in the next room, we sit on our beds and settle the issue the way we have settled all other disputes since we were children. We draw straws. Maria argues in vain that my straw is shorter than hers, that I should go and she should stay. But Olga orders us to lay them down side by side on the floor, and it is clear that I will remain in Tobolsk. I would like to think that Maria's devotion to Alexei is what drives her to tears, but I suspect it is Ivan she does not want to leave. My parents' trunks are packed quickly and thoroughly with the basic necessities, while cook hustles to make a last meal of borscht and hens stuffed with rice and hazelnuts. I wish, morbidly, that he had cooked diavol, but I don't say it aloud. My parents are not in the mood for jokes tonight. So we eat our dinner quietly, without fanfare. None of us have much of an appetite. "What will we do while you're gone?" I ask, finally, unable to bear the silence around the table any longer.
"Exactly what you're doing now, Shibzik," Father says. "You will do your lessons and run the house and care for your brother."
"But Alexei will be well soon," Mother interrupts. "Then you will join us." I hear the note of obstinate belief in her voice and I don't argue. There's no point upsetting her more. I've been afraid since Yurovsky's announcement, but now I'm angry as well, because I want my mother to comfort me, and she doesn't. She is drowning in her own fear and cannot be bothered to assuage mine. This, I suppose, is what it means to be grown. I add this feeling to the list of things I hate. The day soon evaporates, and then there is nothing left to do but whisper goodnight and go to bed. My sisters and I toss and turn in our beds that night, listening to one another fret while the dogs snore at our feet. Yakov comes to collect our parents, Maria, Dova, and Trop in the morning, but he doesn't allow us to accompany them to the dock. As we have every other time, we are forced to say our goodbyes at the house. They are quick, stoic, and tearless. We all stand in a dismal circle on the front porch as my parents and sister are wrapped in lambskin coats and driven away without comment. Behind them rattle two carts loaded with trunks carrying the last of Mother's hidden treasure, all the large pieces that were too cumbersome and heavy to sew into our clothes. Yakov is gone, at least, but he leaves Semyon in command. The first thing that odious man does once the Rus steams away from Tobolsk is to dismiss Leshy from his service.
I have performed my duties faithfully,
Leshy argues as they stand in the hallway between father's study and the schoolroom. Semyon shrugs. He cannot match Leshy's physical presence, so he relies on his rank instead.
Your services are no longer required. You and your men are to pack your things and report to the garrison commander in Petrograd immediately.
Leshy dares not look to where I am standing, just inside the study, listening.
You cannot send us all away. You will be grossly understaffed. I'm not. You will leave the 20 men stationed in this house, and you will remind them that all forms of insubordination will result in a visit to the firing squad. It is a pity,
Leshy says, his voice heavy with contempt,
that Bolshevik diplomacy always equips one man with a rifle and the other with a blindfold.
Semyon laughs at him.
Do you know why Lenin was able to wrest control from the provisional government? Because he understands that a revolution is useless without a firing squad. So, you are Bolshevik now. Pity I did not know your loyalty sooner.
Again, Semyon laughs, and I cringe at the sound.
If you had been paying attention, you would have realized that I have no loyalties.
We don't see Semyon again until after dinner when he barges into the study, now rather bare since being stripped of several pieces of furniture and father's personal effects. While he speaks to all of us, his eyes are on Olga. Her face burns and she stares at her lap as he says,
"Things will be different under my command. It's time the three of you learn to respect authority. You will report all household expenses to me directly for approval. Your tutor will also be required to submit his lesson plans on a weekly basis so I can determine whether your education has become subversive."
It is so hard not to lose control, to scream or throw something at this cruel, arrogant bastard. But that's what Semyon wants. He is looking for an excuse to punish us, looking for a way to make our lives even more miserable, to shrink them further, to crush every last scrap of joy. And I will not give him the satisfaction. Olga remains still, avoiding him altogether. But Tatiana's hands tremble as she holds needle and thread in her pinched white fingers. Thankfully, we have long since finished our work with the corsets. Tonight we are simply mending skirts and blouses that have grown threadbare from too much wear and washing.
Well?
He demands, eager for an argument. Imperiousness is our only weapon, and we use it to good effect, refusing to acknowledge his pronouncement. Tatiana and I regard him with every bit of disinterest we can muster. There are ways to make a man like Semyon feel small. You look at him with pity. It's far more effective than disdain. You cooperate with his demands, but in a way that makes him feel you're only doing so because he is weak and must be cosseted. The goal is to make him hate himself for being a man unworthy of respect. We learned all these techniques in the years we spent in the Imperial Court, and we unleash them on Semyon as he stands before us in the study. He does not take it well. The remaining staff is busy, Botkin with Alexei, Gilliard in his rented rooms, Cook in the kitchen, so we are left alone to hear Semyon's final threat.
And you will no longer be allowed to lock your bedroom doors at night.
He reaches for the doorknob and strokes it obscenely. He flicks his tongue between the gap in his teeth.
The locks have already been removed, on my orders.
I wake sometime in the middle hours of the night to the deep warning sound of Jimmy's growl. As usual, he sleeps at the foot of my bed, and I feel the rumble in my legs like a train picking up speed. I blink heavily and peer into the darkness. It takes a moment for me to see the shadow, charcoal against the blackness of the room. My heart begins ticking faster when the shadow moves, and my breath catches in my throat as the figure takes a step toward Olga's bed. Slowly, quietly, I slide my hand beneath my pillow and feel the cold metal of the paper knife I smuggled out of Father's study at the Alexander Palace. I have slept with it beneath my pillow every night since Yakov came. There, in the darkness, I can see Semyon's profile outlined against the window. I can see him lean over Olga and tug at the front of his trousers. I can hear his breath, heavy and filled with lust. "You cannot be in here," I say, gripping the handle of my paper knife a little tighter. Jimmy leaps to the floor with a thump, his growl deeper and more menacing now. "Go, or I will turn him loose." Semyon takes a step back from Olga's bed, hands up in surrender.
"If that dog ever touches me, I'll kill him."
His words are slurred, but I think there is a note of fear there as well, because he continues to move backward toward the door. I lie there, smelling the scents of angry canine and drunk soldier long after Semyon is gone.
Chapter 21. Anna. Entrapment. 1927, 1926, 1925. Wasserburg am Inn, Germany. May 11th, 1927. The town of Wasserburg sits in the bulb at the top of a hairpin curve in the river Inn. It's a teardrop-shaped peninsula, surrounded by a natural moat, and connected to the picturesque countryside by a narrow sliver of land. Like many cities in Bavaria, it is filled with colourful buildings, old-world charm, and a sense of history that cannot be recreated in larger, more modern cities. Bicycles lean against walls, their small baskets filled with bread loaves and bouquets. The occasional horse-drawn cart clatters down the cobblestone streets. Flower boxes crowd the windows, and clotheslines stretch across the alleys. There are statues and arched doorways and fountains around every bend. Anna thinks it is the most beautiful and delightful place she's ever seen. The Wasserburg Inn looks like something from a Bavarian postcard, with its white plaster walls, dark timber accents, red roof and climbing vines. The street smells of yeast, of bread and beer. She half expects to see a man in lederhosen when she and Gleb pass through the heavy double doors. What they find instead is far more troubling. Dmitri Luchtenberg, oldest son of her current sponsor, Romanov cousin, and a man who has been for the last year a continual thorn in her side. Anna stops short and turns to Gleb.
"Why is he here? He's supposed to be in Copenhagen."
"I don't know," Gleb mutters, but his eyes are on the other two men seated at the large round table. One of them Anna has met before, the other she hasn't.
"Let me guess," she growls. "That's your private investigator?"
She takes his silence as an affirmation. Gleb talked her into this meeting by saying he'd met a detective who could help them gather irrefutable proof that she is Anastasia. Gleb has been corresponding with the man for months, trading letters back and forth, discussing their plan for bringing this business to a conclusion once and for all. But the way this man chats and laughs with Dmitri makes it obvious they have been betrayed. Anna knows this because she knows the face of the third man seated with them. She knows why he wandered into a mental institution near Berlin 7 years ago. "We should go," Gleb says, placing a hand at the small of her back. It's a protective gesture, an intimate gesture. He has taken to touching her like this since his arrival back in Germany, trying to make his intentions clear. He has grown familiar with her, and she is unsure how to feel about it. Anna does not know how to surrender to his affections, nor is she certain that she wants to. But it's too late to leave the inn now. They have been spotted. Gleb's private investigator approaches where they stand in the doorway. He extends a hand to Anna. "Martin Knopf," he says. When she doesn't accept the hand, he motions them toward the table. "Please, we have much to discuss." They could run, or refuse, or make a scene, but that would only complicate the situation. Anna allows herself to be led by the elbow to the table. Martin Knopf pulls out her chair. Gleb slides into the one beside her with a curse. The private investigator nods at each of them in turn. "Good to see you again, Mr. Botkin. I assume by now that you have realized my duplicity in getting you here. For that I would apologize." "It would be in vain," he says. "I cannot fault your animosity, which is why I'll get directly to the point." The private investigator grins, not out of triumph, but because he is, strangely, a man of impeccable manners. He turns to Anna. "I assume you know these gentlemen, Dmitri Lochtenberg and Felix Schanskowska." There are half-empty frosted mugs on the table in front of each of them. Anna fears she has wandered into a celebration. "I am well acquainted with Dmitri," she says, "but I do not know this other man." Felix is going to speak, but Anna glares at him. He looks to the private investigator instead. "There appears to be a difference of opinion regarding that detail," the private investigator says. "Mr. Schanskowska has assured me in great detail that he does know you, that he has known you for some time, in fact." "Then Mr. Schanskowska is lying." Unfazed, the private investigator continues. "I feel we are getting ahead of ourselves. Please, let me explain my presence here." Anna snorts. "I believe they call it entrapment, or are you unfamiliar with the term?" "Are you currently in the act of committing a crime?" His voice is suddenly firm, sharp. "Because if not, I'd say that's the wrong word. I prefer to think of my work here today as unmasking." "I wear no masks." "Another point of contention, I'm afraid." "Speak plainly, Mr. Knopf. My patience is wearing thin." "Very well. Before I met your friend, Mr. Botkin, my services were engaged by Dmitri, on behalf of his family, certain members of the Romanov family, to determine your true identity. I have made my identity plain. It is the belief of the Romanov family. My family is dead. Your family has nothing to do with the Romanovs, a point that Mr. Schanskowska can attest to." He gives Felix a pointed look. "The recognized, legal, and surviving family of Tsar Nicholas II believe that you are a fraud." Anna glances at Gleb, and then back at the private investigator. "And they hired you?" "Correct." "And you hid this fact from Gleb?" "Yes." Gleb offers a miserable groan and waves the barmaid over. He orders a pint of Schwarzbier and pinches the bridge of his nose. "Shit. How could I be so stupid?" And then, "Anna, what would you like?" "I hate beer." And she does. All her years of drinking have not changed this absolute reality. Beer tastes like horse piss marinated in despair. "Pear cider, then. I know how you love pears." "Sure," she says dryly. The private investigator waits politely for them to receive their order before continuing. Gleb's lager, which comes a few moments later, is so thick and rich it's almost black. It looks like tar to Anna. She takes a tentative sip of her cider. It is surprisingly sweet and refreshing, and she takes another pull at the frosted glass, summoning a bit of courage for whatever comes next. "Mr. Botkin believed I was working on his behalf," the private investigator says. "This artifice, though unfortunate, was necessary to ascertain the truth." "Because you knew I would refuse to attend this meeting otherwise, especially considering that I am without recourse or legal representation." He shrugs. "I am afraid that is your concern, not mine." "How very churlish of you." Dmitri Leuchtenberg sets his elbows on the table and leans toward Anna. "You might have my father convinced, but not me, or my mother, or anyone else in my family. I knew you weren't who you claimed to be the moment I saw you, and now I can prove it." Dmitri has been like sand in her underwear from the moment she arrived at Castle Zeon, abrasive, constantly grinding on her nerves. He is arrogant and contentious. He protests every mark spent on her care. He resents his father's devotion and the staff's enchantment. Dmitri's mother alone shares his disdain, and they nurse their grievances by pen and telephone with the family at every possible opportunity. It was her understanding that Dmitri and his mother would be in Copenhagen this week, arguing their case directly before the Dowager Empress. Dmitri leans back in his chair and motions for Felix to speak. "Tell them who you are." "Felix Schwanskowska." "And who is this woman?" He hesitates only a moment before turning to Anna, his eyes dark and pleading, desperate. "This woman is my sister, Franziska, a Polish factory worker missing this 7 years." "You are lying," Gleb says, slamming his stein down on the table. He flings lager from his fingers and Anna dodges the spray. "I ought to know my own sister." "Then you are mistaken, or in the pay of Dmitri." "That is uncalled for," Dmitri shouts, slamming his own mug down on the table. "What's in it for you?" Gleb asks. "Has the Dowager Empress promised you a title? Or a trust fund? Why are you working so hard to discredit Anna?" "Because the memory of my cousin shouldn't be dishonored by a charlatan." Anna hates the barbaric nature of men, the way they long to fight and draw blood, the way they need to prove their point with brute force. So when both Gleb and Dmitri push back from the table, she also rises. "Enough," Anna says. "I have had enough of all of you." She does not say goodbye to any of them, offers no formalities or polite excuses. She simply leaves the inn and lets them think what they will. It will be used against her at some point, no doubt. Another bit of circumstantial evidence that she is not courtly enough to be a Grand Duchess. Anna is halfway down the street before Gleb catches up with her. "We'll go to America," he declares. "We'll prove your case there." "You don't ever give up, do you?" He grabs her arm and stops abruptly before a flower shop. Directly across the street is the little antique shop she visited with Tanya yesterday. "Is that what you want?" Gleb asks, his hand softening on her arm. "Do you want me to give up, like everyone else?" "No." "Then let me help you. Let me make up for this damned fiasco. Let me find other sympathizers, other means of support. You need to get out of Europe for a while. You need to find a fresh audience. The Russian loyalists here are too jaded, too political." "I don't know anyone in America."
"You know me?"
Anna's head swims a bit. Too much has happened in too short a time. She drank her cider on an empty stomach, and her eyes feel heavy, like they might roll out of her face at any moment. She needs a nap, or food, or both. Something, anything, but this incessant scheming. "Nothing will come of this, Gleb," she says, shifting away from his touch.
"But if it does, if I can raise support, will you come?"
He's pleading, desperate to fix his mistake.
"Please."
"If you are able to arrange the details, I will come to America." One day earlier. Wasserburg am Inn, Germany. May 10th, 1927. "Here," Tanya Botkin says, pulling Anna toward a small shop, whose sign reads simply, Antiques. This is the place I was telling you about. From the outside, it hardly looks like a black market emporium for Imperial Russian goods, nor does it on the inside. As they enter, a little bell rings above the door, announcing their arrival, and bits of dust whirl through a patch of sunlight on the worn wooden floor. The shop is long and narrow, with a tall ceiling that makes Anna feel as if she has just stepped into a tunnel. The space is filled with old rugs and heavy pieces of ornate furniture. The walls are covered with gilded mirrors, while half the flat surfaces showcase Tiffany lamps in primary colours. "May I help you?" a pretty young shop girl asks. Anna would guess she's not a day over 20. Too young to be dealing in stuffy antiques and expensive home accessories. "Is Albert in today?" Tanya asks. Gleb's sister is the sort of woman who is pretty, but only when she smiles, and she turns on the charm for this young shopkeeper, showcasing a row of straight, bright teeth. The girl runs her hand through her ponytail, letting the strands fall between long, thin fingers. "Perhaps. May I give him your name?" Tanya hands the girl a card, folded in half with her initials embossed on the outside. The girl turns elegantly, her hair and the hem of her skirt swirling out behind her, and retreats through a door at the back of the shop without another word. A dancer, Anna thinks. She has to be a dancer. Most likely a ballerina. Normal women can't move like that. The girl returns minutes later and motions them to follow. They pass through a heavy wooden door, down a hallway, around a corner, and into what appears to be a broom closet. Anna stops short, confused, but the girl tugs on a sconce attached to the back wall and a panel slides aside. "Watch your step," the shop girl says. "The stairs are quite steep." And rickety. And poorly lit. They go down single file, holding onto the wall for balance. Anna has an innate fear of cellars. She would turn and bolt back toward the daylight if Tanya were not blocking her escape. "Go on," her friend whispers. "I promise you it's safe." "We shouldn't have come without Gleb. He's meeting with the private investigator. Don't worry. We'll be fine." "I hate it when people tell me that. It never turns out to be true." And then they step into an opulent, well-lit basement. The room is filled with lamps and cabinets. There are ample places to sit. Couches and chairs and divans, all of them padded and covered with rich brocade. Anna has never seen so many knick-knacks and paintings and chests. There are at least a dozen swords mounted to the walls, jewellery cases, shelves upon shelves of books, an entire case of knives, one Fabergé egg on a marble column in the middle of the room, and any number of wooden boxes, baskets, and bins. "Welcome," announces a voice filled with age and gravitas in Russian. Anna suspects that the man who offers them a stiff, formal bow is older than anything in this room. He is as thin as a table leg and as wiry as a billy goat. He has a long white beard, but not a single hair atop his head. His teeth remain, all of them straight, but he is in possession of only one milky eye. Or so she assumes, for the other is covered with an embroidered patch. And clearly the man has a sense of humour, because the image stitched on the patch in gold thread is an evil eye. "Albert," Tanya steps forward to clasp his hand, "thank you so much for seeing us. I have heard that this place is astonishing, but the rumours do not do it justice." He receives this compliment silently, waits a beat, and says, "Tatiana Botkin, daughter of Eugen Botkin, physician to the Imperial Family of Russia, how may Albert assist you today?" He asks this bizarrely in the third person. Tanya elbows Anna in the ribs and shakes her head slightly, indicating it's best not to ask. "I would like you to meet my friend, Anastasia," she says. Albert peers at Anna with that single eye for a great length of time. She feels as if her skin will peel away under the examination. And then suddenly, the old man drops into another stiff bow. "Tsarevna," he whispers. I am at your service. She is at a total loss, but Tanya eases between them to tell Albert the reason for their visit. I have been told that you trade in certain items, small things of sentimental value to those loyal to the old regime. My friend would like a memento to take with her, something to remind her of happier days.
What you have heard is true, but I deal not only in small things. I can acquire almost anything, large or small, if time and resources are not limited.
Anna laughs, and Tanya clears her throat, clarifies. Unfortunately, we are only here for a couple days, and funds are, finite. Albert nods, unruffled by their predicament.
This is not a problem. I have many things that might be of interest to you.
He offers Anna his arm as though helping her into a carriage.
May I?
Tanya gives her an assuring nod, and Anna places her hand on the fine silk of his sleeve. He leads her like a military escort through the cavernous basement. Albert says nothing, points out nothing in particular. He simply watches Anna's face for any signs of interest, and when she slows or looks at something for more than a second or two, he elaborates on the provenance of an item, or in some cases, gives an explanation of the item itself. When Anna lifts an ornate ivory pawn from a chess set, Albert sighs.
Yes, you have good taste. Do you play?
Not in many years.
This was carved by hand from the tusks of an African bull elephant. At one time the animal was a pet of Tsarevich Alexei. The elephant was killed at the beginning of the revolution under orders of Alexander Kerensky. The traitor took the tusks for himself and commissioned this set.
Anna holds the pawn in her hand, running her thumb over its edges and curves lovingly. There is no emotion in her voice.
A beastly thing to do. War is beastly, Tsarevna. But do not fret. The chess set was confiscated from Kerensky's office when the Bolsheviks took power.
The Bolsheviks were worse.
True. But at least Kerensky did not have the satisfaction of keeping his prize.
And how did you come by this? He moves on, taking her with him.
Albert never reveals how he comes by his treasures.
They drift through the room, Tanya at their heels, until they come to a crowded shelf at the back. It is filled with smaller, tattered items, an ink drawing ripped from a sketchbook, a broken fountain pen, a chipped hand mirror. Anna lifts an old, worn icon from the shelf. She raises it to her mouth and blows away a thin layer of dust.
Saint Anna of Kashin, Albert says, the holy protector of women. This icon once belonged to Viktor Zobrovsky, captain of the Imperial Guard, and held a message written by Empress Alexandra begging the British monarchy for help during the revolution. I am told that Zobrovsky was stopped on his way to Petrograd, shortly after being dismissed from the palace. The icon was taken from him, and the message destroyed. As you know, help never arrived for the Imperial family.
Yes, Anna says, her voice a whisper.
I know.
Albert pats her hand and moves forward again, but Anna stops him.
How much for the chess set and the icon?
He looks at her, his eye clouded and watery.
For you, Tsarevna, nothing.
One day earlier. Castle Zeon, Germany. May 9th, 1927. Castle Zeon was once a Benedictine monastery, but is now a sprawling lakeside castle, occupied by a family that cannot decide whether Anna is friend or foe. The father champions her cause, while the mother and son thwart it at every opportunity. They are a house divided. For her part, Anna tries to avoid the lot of them whenever possible. This is easy enough, given the size of the estate, and she spends most of her time reading in her room or exploring the grounds. Built over 1,000 years earlier, Castle Zeon has been a medicinal spa populated by bohemians, a barracks
used to house any number of Russia's armies during any number of her wars. It has seen countless lives and been witness to countless stories. It has spied on chaste monks and wanton artists. These walls have been built and burned and razed and built again times without number. They have housed Haydn and Mozart, priests and soldiers, scholars and lunatics. At the moment, however, the Duke of Lichtenberg and his acrimonious family claim ownership. Anna loves to wander the spacious confines of these ancient walls, visiting the crypt and then the oratory, the chapel and the ballrooms, the library and the now vacant infirmary. But the towers, with their onion-shaped copper roofs, are her favourite place, and she climbs them on clear days to look across the lake. Occasionally she wanders through the cemetery and counts the gravestones of the long-dead abbots who gave their lives in service to God, and now their bodies in service to the flowering bushes that line the castle walls. The walls are white, and the roof is red, and the lake reflects this image in perfect upside-down symmetry. If it were not for its occupants, the castle would be nothing short of magical. It sits on an island in the middle of Lake Zeon-Azeon, and is connected to the mainland by a narrow causeway. The water is deep and blue, peppered with lily pads and cattails along the shore. There is a small dock beside the boathouse, and sometimes, when the weather is warm, Anna sits on the edge and dangles her feet in the water. When Anna first arrived at Castle Zeon, she had a steady stream of visitors, either skeptical aristocrats maneuvering themselves into position for some future advantage, or extended members of the Romanov family peering at her with suspicion, looking for reasons to reject her out of hand. These days, she entertains few people who are not friends. Mostly she sees Gleb and Tanya Botkin. Today she sits with Tanya in the tidy kitchen garden, on a carved stone bench between fragrant bushes of rosemary and lavender. Anna doesn't cook, can't, in fact, remember the last time she stood in front of a stove, but she does enjoy being in this place, watching things grow, nibbling on the herbs. Tanya plucks a sprig of rosemary from the bush and rolls it between her thumb and forefinger. She inhales the scent and then flicks the twig away. Have things gotten any better with Dmitri? Anna cranes her head to look at the terrace 3 floors above them. Dmitri Luchtenberg's suite overlooks the garden, and sometimes, when she knows that he is in residence, she sits here to torment him. What do you think? Tanya laughs. Still being an odious prick, is he? And recruiting others to his cause. Meaning? He left for Copenhagen 2 weeks ago. Tanya groans. Ugh, spiteful bastard. With his mother, Anna adds. To make their case with the Dowager Empress in person? What could you have possibly done to light that sort of fire under him? Expose his sexual proclivities to the press? When Tanya smiles, her face is transformed from unremarkable to the sort of pretty that makes a man trip over his own feet. She knows this, of course, and has developed a wicked sense of humour that gives her ample opportunity for laughter. It's a pity she doesn't have her brother's cheekbones, Anna thinks. They would match her smile perfectly. I know nothing of his proclivities, Anna says, nor do I want to. Well, you must have done something. He's usually content to fester in private. We got into an altercation the day before he left. About? The Haute-Gritier Navigatier. Tanya shakes her head, confused. That's a new low for him. Why on earth would he want to argue about the opening of navigation? Because I knew what it was and what it meant. Because I got it right, and every time I explain something correctly, it infuriates him. He doesn't like being proven wrong. He hates the fact that his father believes me, so he is determined to see me proven a fraud. Such a pity the man has the disposition of a hemorrhoid. He's devilishly handsome. Well, the devil can take him as far as I'm concerned.
The garden gate swings open, and Gleb steps onto the gravel path.
The devil can take who? He asks.
Dmitri.
Fair enough. but I'd like to get my fists on him first.
Then you'll have to go to Copenhagen, Anna says. He's currently maligning my character almost 1,000 kilometers away.
Excellent. He won't be able to meddle in our plans.
Tanya looks at her brother with suspicion. He's nearly bursting at the seams with enthusiasm.
You're here early, she says.
I thought we'd get a head start. He turns to Anna. Are you ready?
Do I have to go?
He does that thing with his lip that Anna finds charming, where he pulls the bottom left corner between his teeth and chews lightly in an awkward half-smile.
You said you would,
she grunts, entirely unladylike.
Remind me why I agreed.
Because I want you to?
Unlikely.
Because I asked?
Blackmailed.
Cajoled, really. It was more like a gentle prompt, if we're being honest. Besides,
he grins widely,
this will help our cause. It's just a few days in Wasserburg. This man can help us establish your identity. With any luck, we'll have it wrapped up before Dmitri returns.
What's his name?
Anna asks.
The one you're bringing me to meet.
You've been very secretive about him. Martin Knopf.
What does he do?
He's a private investigator, and he will, I am certain, help us prove your identity once and for all.
And how exactly did you meet him?
We have been corresponding for some time. He has been looking into your claims at my request.
And you trust him?
Why wouldn't I?
16 months earlier. Mommsen Clinic, Berlin. January 1926. Gleb sets the folded newspaper down carefully on the table beside Anna's bed. She's been in the clinic for months, unable to fully heal from a tubercular infection in her lungs. But even with the fever and the infernal ringing in her ears, she can hear him sigh. It's a sound that has grown familiar in the last few years. He's gotten some news that he doesn't want to tell her.
What?
She asks, and her voice is raspy, her throat swollen and raw from coughing. Fingers lightly brush the hair away from her forehead.
I didn't mean to wake you. I'm sorry.
You didn't. Now tell me, what are you reading?
The National Nyhedsunder. I'm not familiar with that paper. It's out of Copenhagen.
Ah, the city of liars.
Don't you mean spires?
Gleb asks. She curls her lip in response.
No, I do not.
Anna lets her body go limp into the pillows again. After weeks of fever and coughing, with her lungs heavy with fluid, even the smallest things, like sitting up, feel overwhelming.
So, what's the bad news?
The Tsar's older sister has been quoted in an article.
Saying?
Very unflattering things.
Anna reaches for a rose-colored silk shawl beside her pillow and runs the fabric through her fingers.
That doesn't make any sense. She sent me this for Christmas, a month ago.
Let's just say I doubt you'll be getting any more gifts from her.
Anna studies the shawl dispassionately. She runs her thumb over the tiny stitches along the seam. It's handmade, expensive, luxurious. 4 weeks ago, she considered it a sign that the Tsar's sister had made up her mind about her identity.
Read it, she says.
I don't think. Then just read the worst part. That's all that matters anyway.
Gleb clears his throat and begins to read.
Frau Andersen leaves the impression of a poor, highly strong invalid who believes in her story and is confirmed in the belief by the people around her. We hope that she can be freed of this idée fixe in the Berlin clinic where she is now being treated.
How did they know I was here?
Pierre Gilliard, I believe.
And how does he know I'm here?
You don't remember?
Anna coughs again, and she can taste blood in her mouth. The spasm lasts for nearly a minute, and she is thoroughly winded afterward.
Remember what? She takes a shaky breath.
Exactly. That he came to interrogate you in October.
Anna stares at the ceiling. There is a vague memory that presses against her mind. A man in dark clothing, endless questions, a sharp, raging headache, but nothing concrete. She shakes her head.
No. Of course you don't. You were bedridden with fever, delirious, in fact. Not that he cared, but he made his judgment about you in that condition, and will not be moved from it now. I could kill the staff for letting him in to see you.
He says I am a fraud.
Oh, he says worse than that.
Gleb shakes the newspaper and then stabs it with the end of one finger.
He says you are a vulgar adventuress and a first-rate actress. Pierre Gilliard has become the lead witness in their case against you.
3 months earlier. Mommsen Clinic, Berlin. October 1925. It feels as though someone is standing on Anna's chest, as though she has to fight for every breath. She can hear the swamp beneath her ribs, the air moving and bubbling inside her damp lungs. Anna can't lift her head from the pillow, or her hands from where they lie at her sides. Her temples throb and her eyes water. She wants to sleep, but there is someone talking loudly beside her bed.
"Do you know who I am?"
a man demands. Anna turns her head, tries to focus. His head is there, dark hair, pale skin. His voice seems familiar, but she can't make out the features of his face. She tries to tell him this, but the words won't form properly, and he takes the shaking of her head as a no. Anna is freezing despite the three heavy blankets that cover her. Wave after wave of chills wash over her body, raising goosebumps on her skin and making her muscles seize. She wants to curl into a ball and sleep. She wants this man to go away. But still he interrogates her, one question after another, a relentless stream.
"Tobolsk," he says. "Tell me what you remember of Tobolsk."
"Tell me about our last conversation.
Do you remember why you were punished in the schoolroom that day? Tell me what you remember of your Latin. The Anastasia I knew was fluent in French. Tell me something in that language. What was the last thing I said to you on the train platform in Ekaterinburg?"
On and on and on he goes, the hard notes of each syllable matching the fractious pounding in her skull.
"Why are you here?" Anna whispers.
He leans close to her ear, and she can feel the warmth of his breath against her skin.
"I want proof."
"Look at me."
Anna heaves each word from her burdened chest.
"That is all the proof I have."
She sees his head turn as he takes in her small emaciated form, her jutting collarbone, her spindled arms, sunken cheekbones. Unable to eat, unable to sleep, she has lost weight in recent weeks.
"The Anastasia I knew was round and pretty. You are something else entirely."
There is a whoosh and a clang as the infirmary door swings open and slams shut, and a nurse is standing at her bedside.
"You have to go now, Monsieur Gilliard. Your time is up."
Chapter 22. Anastasia. The Baggage. 1918. Tobolsk, Russia. May 3rd.
"Your parents were not taken to Moscow,"
Pierre Gilliard says as soon as we enter the schoolroom.
"Yakov has them imprisoned in Ekaterinburg, about 560 kilometers southeast of here."
Tatiana shakes her head. "No, that can't be right. Ekaterinburg is in the heart of..."
"The penal colonies," Gilliard finishes for her. "I know. I find this alarming as well."
"So you've heard from him?" Tatiana asks, hope and desperation lighting her eyes. Gilliard pulls a letter from his coat pocket. He stares at it for a moment, but does not open it, deciding, I think, to summarize it instead. He has the look of a man who is trying to withhold something, to soften a blow.
"They arrived safely 4 days ago. Word had gotten out, of course, and there was an angry horde of protesters waiting for them at the station, demanding they be hung on the spot. To his credit, Yakov refused to hand them over. After a 3-hour impasse, they were taken to the Ipatiev house by military escort. I don't realize I'm holding my breath until it comes out in a rush.
They are safe then?
Yes, but all of their trunks were thoroughly searched upon arrival. Gilliard says this carefully, gauging our reaction. So there it is. The jewels. I dare a glance at Olga, but her face has gone pale, drained entirely of color. And what of the contents? I ask. Gilliard knows precisely what I mean. Confiscated, he says. Along with a set of maps, a significant amount of cash, and a series of coded letters your father kept hidden in an extra pair of boots. It would seem they were planning to escape. Whatever the plan, it was meant to be executed from Tobolsk, and Yakov has put an end to it. His mouth is pinched as he says this, and I know Gilliard is anguished at the news. He spent many hours poring over those same maps with Father, and I suspect he was at the heart of this plan.
Who was planning to escape?
None of us noticed Alexei enter the schoolroom. He is barefoot and wears nothing but a frayed tunic and a confused expression. He stands there, eyes large and curious, hair sticking out in all directions. His voice, unused for weeks, is deep and hoarse and altogether unfamiliar. It's the voice of a man who has woken from a deep sleep. But he is awake and standing on his own. I reach him first, but the others pile on within seconds. It's a wonder we don't crush him in our delight. However, as with all blessings these days, this one is mixed. Alexei is well enough to stand, which means that soon he will be well enough to travel. And that means the rest of us are headed for the penal colonies in Ekaterinburg as well. 3 weeks later. Tumen train station, May 23, 1918. We travel on the Rus once again from Tobolsk to Tumen. Another 3 days aboard that dank, smelly ship, locked in the hold, under constant watch by Semyon and his soldiers. 30 Red Guards sent from Ekaterinburg arrived the day before with the single purpose of escorting us to join our parents in the Red Ural Mountains. These soldiers are different, even from the ones Yakov brought from Moscow. They are Latvian workers and Hungarian prisoners of war conscripted into service by the Bolsheviks. Men angry at their lot in life, and angrier at us for representing a job they do not want to do. They are frightful looking, with their lewd stares and dirty, ragged uniforms. They smell of sweat and coal mines, and look as though they would cut our throats sooner than speak to us. We carry our most precious items out of Tobolsk in a small trunk. The corsets and camisoles, the belts and hats that we have so carefully stuffed and sewn back together. We keep them near at all times, not daring to let them out of our sight for a moment. The entire contingent of the Red Guard piles onto the Rus, along with the 20 men stationed in the house. The hold feels every bit as claustrophobic as it did a year earlier. The heat is oppressive, the noise of chattering guards enough to make our heads pound. Semyon instructs us there will be no wandering around the ship this time, no loitering on deck or chatting with the crew. We are to stay below, out of sight, and bide our time in a way that will not cause him trouble. Our small retinue once again takes the far corner of the hold. I commandeer a lower bunk and laugh when Jimmy leaps up beside me and licks my face. He lingers at my side constantly, ready to growl and bare his teeth any time soldiers drift near. Yet Jimmy remains oddly silent when one of the guards steps into the aisle and claims the bunk directly opposite mine. Such an intrusion would typically be enough to at least raise the hackles along his spine. But he stays, curled up next to me, chin on his paws, and watches the soldier, tail thumping happily against my leg. Thomas. I lie back on my pillow, arms crossed behind my head, and stare at the underside of Tatiana's bunk. Her legs dangle over the edge, and I see that she's worn a hole straight through the sole of one boot.
I'm surprised Yakov hasn't sent you away already, I say, barely loud enough for him to hear.
He assumes that we all hate you the way he does.
Thomas sits on the edge of the bed, chin propped on his elbows, looking for all the world.